Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.
I'm gonna make him an offer again with you.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the picture that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello, and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network and Front Row Classics. I'm your host, Brandon Davis. And as the title song of this movie that we're going to talk about says, like Webster's Dictionary, we are Morocco bound. So, this is actually going to be a feed-specific episode of Front Row Classics, our first one, actually. And Eric, you and I have been moving up in the world here with Front Row Classics. How's it going?
Oh, really? We have?
My pay
is exactly the same, though.
Exactly $0.
Things have been going well at the entire Front Row Network. Yeah. But I think Classics, we've been doing really well, too. If you haven't listened to them, go back and listen to the 2 great interviews that are out there on the Classics feeds, Patricia Ward Kelly and then Lucille Ball's granddaughter, Brandon. Her name is
Kate Luckenbill Connor.
Yeah, yeah. And as you said, we've now got our own feed, which is where this podcast can be found. So if you stumbled upon it there and you haven't subscribed to that feed, go ahead and do that as well.
And we're also on Facebook now, our own specific Front Row Classics Facebook page. We just started it, but we're hoping to grow. And so there'll be chances for you to suggest movies. We'll put up a poll every now and then and, you know, see where we go from there. So good to be part of the Front Row at this time in history, even though it's a frustrating point in history. And then our other guest with us, joining us, a couple months ago we had her on, but it's always good to have Allison Means with us. How's it going, Allison?
It's good. It's an interesting world. Interesting time to be alive.
Yes, it is. It is. Well, our choice of movie this month, we're closing out kind of our summer series. We thought we would do some kind of fun series of summer movies, and we've talked about, you know, some horror monster stuff. We've talked about swashbuckling adventures. So we're going to talk about a buddy comedy from the 1940s. Actually, I actually think that this is the first franchise we've talked about on Classics. We've done a sequel with Godfather 2, but I don't think we've done a franchise. And this is the 3rd of 7 movies that we're discussing here. And it's A Road to Morocco from 1942. The Road 2 series, which featured Bob Hope and Bing Crosby. And I just want to give everybody a little plot synopsis of this. I actually found this on just a random plot synopsis on Facebook, but it doesn't really give you the feeling that it is a comedy, but bear with me. Starving vagabond Jeff sells best friend Orville into slavery in a Moroccan marketplace to buy food. Searching for his partner after an attack of conscience, Jeff discovers that Orville is now engaged to the gorgeous Princess Shalmar, whose astrologers have told her that her first husband will die violently, leaving her to marry her beloved Sheikh Mully Kassim. But when the princess falls in love for Jeff, things get complicated. So
it's an understatement there. Things get complicated.
They weren't already complicated.
No. Right. And really, honestly, with the road movies, the plots don't matter.
They're vehicles for songs.
They're vehicles for songs and for funny sight gags. And yeah, so Allison, we'll start with you. Road to Morocco, were you familiar with the Road series before you watched this?
I was familiar with the series, but I had not seen this particular one.
Okay.
I had seen other ones, but not this one.
All right. So what were your first impressions of Road to Morocco?
I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
I have some feelings about race in this movie and women in this movie. No surprises to anyone here. But overall, it was from 1942. I'm reminding myself, 1942 doesn't make it right, but does make it 1942.
Right.
But if you can divorce yourself from that modern lens, it's really fun. It's really fun.
It is. Eric, were you familiar with the Road series?
I was a bit familiar with the series. I had never sat down and watched any of these films, though, and so didn't have any expectations going into it. Found myself laughing within the first couple of minutes of this movie because it's funny. Bing Crosby and Bob Hope are comedians. They are funny guys.
Yeah.
And as you watch it, there are a couple of parts that make you very uncomfortable, and it's the debate is going on right now about what we do with these movies. So it's really timely to be talking about something like this. Gone with the Wind has certainly been in the spotlight lately. The platforms that are showing it are putting a little label that says, view this through the historical context of when it was made. Road to Morocco should definitely have one of those.
Sure.
1942, the depictions of race, the sexes, disabilities. I mean, there are many, many things that are problematic with this movie. Mm-hmm. There are many, many really good things about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Let's celebrate the good things. I think we should be watching all of these movies and discussing what makes them problematic today, and then how do we apply that to movies going forward.
Absolutely.
The other thing I was thinking is this is ripe for a remake. This Road 2 series, if they could come up with a couple of people, and it doesn't have to be men, women, black, white, whatever race, and make a couple of Road 2 movies, you may have some hits on your hands there too.
No joke.
What I love about the Hope and Crosby series is, we talked about the Marx Brothers, Allison and I, mm-hmm. a few months ago, and you have other comedy teams like Abbott and Costello. I can't think of another comedy team in movie history where the two members were of equal star power weight. And you've got Hope and Crosby, who on their own are, megawatt stars, but you put them together and they just work. And it's interesting, just to give everybody a little bit of history, though, I read the pairing of the two of them happened by accident. They'd known each other for years and had performed in vaudeville for years, but there was a script in 1939, I forget what the name of it is, but it was going to pair Bob Hope with George Burns and Gracie Allen, and it was going to be kind of a trio. Mm-hmm. And George and Gracie dropped out for personal reasons or whatever, and so Bob Hope was rising an up and coming star at Paramount, and so they put the two of them together, and they ended up calling it The Road to Singapore. And of course, that's what started it all. And what's so amazing to me is these movies are so meta for a time when movies just were not meta.
Oh my gosh. The number of times that they break the fourth wall and just they're so self-referential. The camel talks about being in a movie. They talk about their contracts with the studio.
I love that line in the
that
in the
line
opening number.
Is incredible.
I
heard that line and
Tim,
I was like, I'm in.
I bet you 5 to 10 will run into Dorothy L'Amour. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and they surely do. The whole darn movie.
Yeah. I absolutely love them as a team, because you've got Crosby, who has this incredibly laid back image, you know, very relaxed image, and Hope, who is just manic. And it's funny, I think nowadays when we think of Hope, we think of this kind of, you know, somewhat hacky comedian, you know, standing, you know, like on the Tonight Show reading off cue cards. But he was awesome in his early days in the 40s and into the 50s. And I think as funny as anybody who's ever been on the screen. So yeah, the two of them together. Let's just talk about Hope and Crosby as a team. We could talk about their individual strengths and stuff. But Allison, what are your thoughts about Hope and Crosby?
I thought they were great. I mean, the way they play off of each other is great. It's not just, you know, like the smart one, the dumb one, which a lot of buddy comedies fall into that. Or like, oh, the smart guy that's, you know, pushing around the dumb one and he's the butt of all the jokes. They're on pretty equal footing as far as they pick on each other. It goes back and forth. And I think, and it makes it better. It's so quick. I mean, I watch all of my movies with subtitles on because I have a toddler. But if you're watching something like this, I mean, the repartee is so quick that you almost need it in order to keep up with what's going on. Yeah. I loved it.
Yeah.
And they were great together.
Yeah. And these movies were definitely scripted, but there was definitely some ad-libbing going on. You know that there was, I wish there were gag reels that existed from this movie, because you know that there was things that were said that probably ended up on the cutting room floor.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm sure.
And I had heard different reports about, and different movies, certainly they had different amounts of ad-libbings, but anywhere from 10 to 20%. Was just Bing Crosby and Bob Hope riffing with each other. And we talked about them breaking the fourth wall. Apparently, Dorothy L'Amour in one of the early movies turns to the camera and says, "Don't I get a line here somewhere?" And it's because they were riffing so much that she jumps in, and they took that, and that became, it's okay now to break the fourth wall in all the subsequent movies. So they made that a thing going forward too. So she fits in with them really well here too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There is a charm to these movies, and it's an easygoing, laid back, you know, the stakes are high, but they're not.
The stakes are high, but they're also thin.
Right.
Yeah, and really, yeah, the plot is just, you know, just a little, like you said, just a little string that holds, you know, musical numbers and sight gags together. But
I'm not mad at it.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, and I read the interesting thing about Road to Morocco and being released in 42, you know, this was shot in 41 before we had entered World War II. And originally this was going to be Road to Moscow. And somebody at Paramount said, "We might not want to do that because Russia's a hot spot right now." And they said the war's never going to reach North Africa.
Wow.
And fast forward a year later, and it was a hot spot. But it didn't matter because it still worked. And, you know, and you had Casablanca was released in the same year. So I think it's funny to compare those two movies together. But we'll get to the cultural depictions here in a little bit. But let's break down the cast. It's not a huge cast. But let's talk about Bing Crosby first. And I think it's interesting that we tend to put Bing Crosby in his little Christmas box, and that's the only time we ever get him out. But Bing Crosby was the biggest star at the time. He was the number one box office star. He was the number one recording star and the number one radio star all at the same time. So there was nobody bigger than Crosby. And he makes everything look so easy. And it's almost like he's not even trying. And
who can whistle like that?
I know. And
he has vibrato.
And
save some for the rest of us, Bing.
What I love about their relationship is that, you know, they're best friends, but Bing doesn't hesitate selling Hope into slavery.
Doesn't even tell him that's what's happening. Just comes back and he's like, "Okay, now don't freak out."
No.
And, but I sold you.
Right. And I love his easygoing demeanor. And you kind of forget what he's like as a young man, you know, because you hear the sort of Christmas recordings that mm-hmm. all took place later in his life. And, you know, his voice had even dropped by the time you hear some of that. And his voice is really nice and bright in this movie. And he's got those bright, bright eyes that show up really well on the camera. And, you know, he's having a great time this entire movie. He's hopping on a camel and he's playing with the fur on it. You know, you can just see the amount of fun that he is having, acting, singing, strolling around, playing off of Bob Hope. It's a great piece of Bing Crosby's work.
What I love about Crosby is he doesn't really fit into any kind of mold. He could never be a Western star. He's not John Wayne. He could never be a romantic. He's not Gable. And as musical stars go, you know, he's not Mystère or a Kelly, but he's perfect at being Bing Crosby.
Yeah.
And that's what he's not
regular guy, Bing Crosby.
He's a regular guy that for some reason, you know, always got attractive women in movies. But
listen, not like the media has changed in that way
that's
at
true.
All.
That's true. Very we'll get to true. That. We'll get to that in a little bit too. What's interesting is this is 42 and Holiday Inn comes out the same year as this movie. And that's two different sides of Crosby. You've got this sort of this, you know, funny comedic side. And then you've got, you know, his, you know, musical romantic side.
Right.
And he's so good. And I love he's got this demeanor that's perfect with Hope. You know, you couldn't put too many people with Hope. Hope was mostly a solo act, but to put somebody very calm and stoic along with Hope, he's kind of the glue with all these movies.
Yeah, they're a good foil for each other.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you've got, I think you said Hope has like a manic quality.
Yeah.
So it would be too much if you had somebody like zany on screen with him. So that it's a good balance for the strengths of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Any particular, I guess as we talk about each person, any particular favorite Crosby moments in this movie?
You know, just when he is strolling along and in the white suit and the fez and he is singing a song, I mean, that is Bing Crosby at his best.
Yeah, quintessential.
That's what you pay your that's worth the price of admission right there to get that. So that's what you want to see in this movie. All the rest is just this great gravy that he delivers to you. He's so even keeled and genial, and it's a fun watch. You know, and like I said, his feeling of having fun comes through the screen.
Yeah, I think that's probably the same for me. Anytime they let him sing, I'm here for it.
Mm-hmm. What strikes me about this movie is like for a funny comedy, the songs could have been throwaway, but the songs are really good.
They are.
Yeah.
Because they're written by James Van Heusen, who was, you know, who wrote a lot of Crosby material. But I love the Ain't Got a Dime to My Name when he's strolling through the Moroccan street. It's a catchy song. Then Moonlight Becomes You is a beautiful ballad.
Gorgeous. And
which became a hit, too, correct? Mm-hmm. I mean, they would have pressed it into vinyl, and it sold very well. So
anything he did became a hit.
True.
Yeah,
with a voice like Butter, I mean...
And, and he and Hope sound great together when they do their duets.
I think
that quintessential moment is them riding on the camel at the beginning, singing Road to Morocco. It's just, it's you know, two guys who are just having a ball.
It really lets you know, like, this is what the movie is.
Yeah.
Here's what to expect.
I found this problematic too, though, because it's called Road to Morocco. They get to Morocco in like the first 3 minutes of the movie.
That's true. They're like, well, that was the road. Here we are.
Well, let's move on though to Bob Hope, Turkey. That's his name.
Little Orville.
Little Orville, who actually plays a dual role. He plays
Turkey. Oh my and gosh! Orville. It's just Bob Hope in a wig, and it's amazing.
but he, yeah. All right. So Bob Hope is a guy that plays with his face a lot, and he's got the great mug. And you know, there's a time on the camera where he turns and gives you a profile, and he raises that eyebrow, and that's the Bob Hope.
The Bob Hope, yeah.
He never does that once as Aunt Lucy, though. Even though it's there are comedic roles, he sells that thing so very well. He does not.
He works that wig.
Exactly. He doesn't take his foot off the gas for that at all.
No.
Yeah, and it's what I appreciated about that, right, is he's not, it's not poking fun at trans people. It's not poking fun at drag. It's just him playing Aunt Lucy.
Yeah, that's right.
The idea is just that's his aunt, and they look alike.
Yes, yes.
And it doesn't give you that gross feeling that a lot of older movies with the joke is a man in a dress.
Yes, exactly. And that was kind of my point. He's never winking at the camera like, hey, look what I'm doing here. This is the joke in a dress. He plays that straight. And I thought it was a good choice.
I agree. It's one of the few things that is controversial that didn't make me go, ugh.
Yeah. And you know, just his... he's fearless in these kind of movies. Like, he's not afraid to go, you know, as far out as he can. And I've always loved that about Hope. And, you know, he's not afraid to have people make fun of his appearance, his nose in particular. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's just great, great little bits. And we'll talk about favorite scenes and favorite gags and stuff later on. But, he's fantastic, and he really, I can tell he respects Crosby, and that's really part of the fun too. You know, if you think about Bob Hope, if he was with another comedian or someone, he'd probably try and steal the thunder and steal the spotlight. But since it's Crosby, he lets Crosby have his moments, and he doesn't try to overtake it, which I always think was great. They always deferred to each other. But let's talk about the female lead in this movie. Let's talk about Dorothy L'Amour. She was in all of these movies with them. She's much a part of the road movies as they are. Mm-hmm. I mentioned to Eric before we went on with this, though, they made these movies in between 1940 and 1952, and then they did a seventh one in 1962 called The Road to Hong Kong. Well, Dorothy L'Amour had to make a cameo because she was deemed too old to be the leading lady. So they cast a 20-something Joan Collins in the...
Nothing against Joan Collins, just...
And yet Hope and Crosby were in their 50s, and that was okay for some reason.
Why? I will never understand that. Well, it's still going on.
Yeah, it still goes on.
It's still gross. I don't get it. Older women are gorgeous too.
Yeah. And talk about a gorgeous woman, Dorothy L'Amour. You don't get much more beautiful.
She's just
absolutely great. And I think she has a really important undervalued job because
I'm sure a lot of it is wigged, but.
But I always thought she had the hardest job in the thing because she had to, the two of them were riffing. She had to keep the scene going and she couldn't break ever.
It's a real Margaret Dumont situation.
Yeah. A Margaret Dumont, but I think a Margaret, she, not quite as stuffy. But
more fun, more on screen.
Mm-hmm. But there's interviews with her where she said it was a challenge knowing to when to interject her lines because she didn't know when the gentlemen were done with their riffing, and so I'm sure that she had to work hard to get herself in those scenes as much as she is.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there's just something about her though. Like she's never dumb in these movies though, which I always appreciate. She's always smart and she's always, you know, willing to play along with the two of them.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Yeah.
I have a lot. I have a lot to say about movies that are like, oh, the women are stupid. Like, no, I'm gonna go no.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
They don't do that, and that I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what, and as you know, and as ridiculous as the situation is where she's using hope because her first husband has to die first.
Found a workaround.
Yeah, but the minute but then she meets Crosby and falls in love with him, and the whole thing changes, and she makes you believe it. It's totally believable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I like in the script, she's sort of like one of the characters out of or maybe even Scheherazade, that is the reader of the 1001 Arabian Nights. Her right. character is kind of like that, more clever than the men that are around her, and sort of wiles her way into getting what she wants, which is not the greatest depiction, but at least she's not this dumb victim circumstance.
A different problematic trope.
Correct.
But I don't think she plays it in that manipulative thing either.
Right.
She's just like, okay, here's the curse thing. So if I'm smart, I'm not going to marry the guy I love first. Why would I do that? That's dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also like Donna Drake, who is Hope's, you know, love interest in the movie. She's a little bit more manipulative, but
yeah,
indeed.
But she does, but everything she does because she genuinely loves Hope. So, but yeah, she's a fun character. The other really main character to talk about is Mully Kassim, who's played by a very young Anthony Quinn, and it's so funny to see, you know, Anthony Quinn, who became such a renowned, you know, Oscar-winning actor in his later career, to really get his start playing straight man to Hope and Crosby. But you can see the potential there right away, because he commands the screen sometimes when he shouldn't.
True. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's just his natural gravitas, you know, and it's part of the build of his face and how he stands, and you know, the fact that he's very well trained in the theatrical arts, and
yeah, he has presence.
Exactly, exactly, and he uses it in this movie, and
sometimes too much.
Yeah, but I also think that it's a good counterbalance to the over-the-top characters that Crosby and especially Hope are playing.
Oh, yeah. It would be easy to lose that character in the bigness of all of the other stuff going on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you do kind of need someone who can just command the scene when not really doing anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he, and you know, that's a scene, that's a character that easily could have been, you know, a cardboard cutout, but he plays it straight, like he should, and he's acting like he's playing Shakespeare, and when you know, when they're doing, you know, shtick all around him, but yeah, I it's great to see him, and he's in another one of the Road movies, I forget which one, but it's funny to see him this early on in his career. But let's move on, let's talk about, and there's movie, as you mentioned, moves so fast, and there's so many lines and gags. But Eric, we'll start with you. What's a favorite scene or a favorite gag?
So several. And yeah, this thing, if people aren't aware, this thing looks more like a Warner Brothers cartoon and how it plays out. And so one of the scenes that I love that you see a lot in the Warner Brothers cartoons is sort of misinformation. So you have the two guys just washed up on and are in the desert, and they're talking about making promises to the ant, and they have this kind of real moment of I love you, and then as the audience you see this camel walk in behind them that is trained to kiss them on their faces, and it's a sight gag, and it's dumb, but it's hilarious. I found myself laughing out loud.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Scene. It's very cartoony is the right right way to describe it. Yeah. And when you take it for what it is in that way and just have some dumb fun for a while, yeah, just let that stuff play for what it is. It's great.
Yeah.
And Hope refers to it as a kangaroo.
Right?
Yeah. My 2-year-old went, "It's not a kangaroo."
Yeah. Allison, what's a favorite of yours?
Another really great moment that I love, which is also pretty cartoony, is when they're being the nodding heads and there's a fly on Hope's face and he's just doing these facial gymnastics to try to get this fly off of him. And then he comes crashing through the front of his little podium and they just knock Bing Crosby down.
There's great physical comedy.
There is. Yeah.
Again, my 2-year-old went, make a mess.
I paused the Blu-ray when I was watching because I own a Blu-ray of this, and I wasn't just to see because when Anthony Quinn knocks Crosby's thing down, I'm like, is that Crosby doing his own stunt? And I paused it real quick, and it was a stunt double. But
it's funny.
It's very good.
It's well cut. Because I didn't notice it.
I mean, in a 1942, you can pause that stuff. So, you know,
right.
we have the disadvantage today of being able to find out all those secrets.
Right.
But yeah, one of the ones that I love, well, you know, it's such a dumb pun and shtick of Hope going in and smoking in the powder room and blowing
times.
Up.
Right, right.
But I love that end scene when he's on the – when they're on that raft and he doesn't realize they're just a few miles away from New York. I could have won an Oscar.
Oh yeah. Self-referential. Loved it.
So good. So good. Well, yeah. And then when they're in the prison cell and Hope is, you know, just reciting what the whole plot and Crosby goes, I know all that. Yeah. The people who came in the middle of the movie don't. You mean they missed my song?
Yes.
So good.
You know what though? I think we mentioned it before. There's four songs in this movie. It's not really a musical, but there are four songs in this. Every one of them is really good and really fits really well.
Yeah.
You know, the first one's very funny. I mean, it's and a very catchy song, which also sort of became a. And I don't know. Are the other road movies? Is that sort of the same thing? Do they sing that same melody?
No, this actually was, I mean, they did a variation on it, but this is unique to this movie. And that song actually was on AFI's list of the 100 greatest film songs of all time.
Okay.
Road to Morocco. Yeah.
And great. But anytime there's music that shows up in this movie, I found that it's not off-putting. It fits with the plot and it's all really well done. That Road to Morocco song too. I know, I don't know if our audience will have a crossover here, but there's a series of episodes of Family Guy where the dog and the baby go on road trips and they sing a version of that song as well, directly lifted from this movie.
Yeah. I forgot about those entirely until you just said that. They do.
And when I was watching the Moonlight Becomes You, where he's singing to Dorothy L'Amour and the way it's lit and everything, I'm like, for like a buddy comedy like this has high production values. This is the way you would do
beautifully there.
This is the way you would light, you know, a budget, you know, epic or something like that. So it didn't matter the genre, they put all that they had into it.
Yeah. And at that time, you know, I'm sure that this is a studio picture.
Yeah.
They just went to the studio staff and say, give us one. Yeah. But they still
And these movies made money. So.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure they printed money on them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because you can shoot the majority of it on the lot.
Oh.
Aside from a couple of exteriors. And for, like, next to nothing, because there's 12 people on the production, there's, like, nobody.
Right.
And they're all on contract anyway.
Mm-hmm.
As they reference in the opening song.
Yeah, and it's perfect because part of the joke is it's all a movie set. And
right. Yeah, it doesn't have to be perfect and look incredibly grand all the time when they're in on the whole idea of this is a movie. Mm-hmm. And they let you know that they know.
Yeah. I love that they're both times they try to do their little patty cake gag, it doesn't work. Because in the other two movies, they use it to punch whoever out, but they said, oh, they're onto us this time.
Yeah, they were like, this thing gets around. Yeah, I really liked that. I enjoy when I enjoy those little self-referential moments a lot, especially when in something like this, it's the third movie of this. So, you know, when stuff gets recycled, the audience could be like, oh, they did that in that one.
Yeah.
So you're letting the audience know, like, no, we know, we're not dumb. It's a thing. Get on board. We're doing a thing. It's almost like a really extended comedy rule of three.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Like, where they flipped it on its ear.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Any other favorite gags or scenes? I mean, there's a ton of them.
Different camels, but the ones that sort of have the Clutch Cargo painted on cartoon mouths and talk to each other.
I'm glad you're a camel too, Mabel.
And
Rolly Eye.
I mean, so, okay, well, I know we're getting into problematic territory here again. Is this a world where all camels talk? How come the camel at the beginning of the movie didn't talk? Or is this just somebody?
Are some camels sentient and some are not?
And just these two that were apparently invited into the tent, are they?
This is a real goofy Pluto situation.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Really, yeah.
But I mean, they don't have to explain any of that stuff because it's just another goofy gag.
It's just silly.
It's funny. It's just funny.
Yeah. And the whole scene where they're sneaking into, what was the one? Oh, it was the one where they were able to disarm the guard.
He's telling them the story about how he got disarmed.
Oh, we like did this? It again.
Ahmed, we did it again. When they're in the tent.
Yeah.
And it's like, don't look now, Junior. I think we're standing on a rug.
Yeah.
I also have the reprise of Moonlight Becomes You when they see the mirage of Dorothy L'Amour.
Oh my gosh.
And they're lip syncing.
Is so surrealist. I was like, what is happening in this movie? I love it.
Yeah, it got looser. It got looser as it went on.
It did. It really did. They're all singing Dorothy's voice. Dorothy has their voices. They kiss each other at the end. What a wild ride.
Oh man.
Also, in the mirage of the drive-in, the girls are just throwing hamburgers. They're just chucking hamburgers at the camera. What? I love it. It's just surrealist.
Yeah.
In the best way.
Yeah, and going back to Aunt Lucy, when Bob Hope stuffs the ghost of Aunt Lucy in the pillow.
Right. I didn't know you could do that with ghosts.
No, I didn't know.
No, you could just roll them up and stick them in the foot of your bed.
Yeah.
Oh,
who needs
Ghostbusters? I watched this movie. I watched this movie with my 14-year-old daughter, and her comment sort of left me speechless. She said, "Boy, that's not what I expected from a classics movie." And I was like, "Okay, what do you mean on that?" She's like, "That's just a silly, goofy movie." And I was like, yeah, those existed then too. You know, she's seen, you know, goofy comedies now, and sort of 80s is as far back as she has gotten. So I felt really good about her seeing something even older than that, that was, that had the ability to be goofy. And then her other comment was, as soon as Crosby and Hope start singing, she's like, "This sounds like a Christmas song." I was like, "Oh, okay,
that's just Bing Crosby
into your consciousness, right?"
This is before he was Mr. Christmas.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we've talked about favorite scenes, but let's move into some of the meatier stuff here. As we said, this is a movie made in 1942. The world was different in 1942. There are certain things that when we watch these movies, we mention it's a wonderful movie. It's a funny movie. But there are things that are problematic about it. I'm used to watching old movies, so I'm used to seeing racial depictions that are not good. I'm used to seeing gender. The one that bugged me when I saw this again was when they made fun of the mentally disabled, because I'd forgotten about that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was not great.
And that is the one thing that really made me cringe, because Hope really gets into that.
Yeah.
It's not good.
No. But, once again, and they really skirt around the description of it. Allah did not grant him wisdom or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know what they're getting at. They don't come right out and say it, but you know what they're getting at.
And the thing is, it was completely unnecessary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It
didn't add a single thing.
And to me, this felt like really the one time where they were sort of punching down, where they were, the other depictions that are problematic.
They don't feel mean spirited.
Right. And they're still wrong.
Yeah.
But there was ignorance involved with those. Yes. Mm-hmm. This one felt a little bit more like they were purposely setting out to make fun of someone. Societally, though, this is the age of institutions in the United States, where someone with those types of disabilities would have been sent away. I mean, so culturally, we were not sensitive to those things. We should have been, certainly, but it didn't exist the same way then.
Right. But, you know, it's important for us to talk about this stuff so that we recognize it and we don't fall into those same traps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's like you were saying, it's important for us to watch these movies that are problematic for this reason. If you just sweep it under the rug, what if we learned?
Exactly. And I think discussions like this go to help those things as well.
Yeah. So I know, Eric, you had talked about what's one of the cultural depictions that you were just wanting to discuss.
Well, and certainly all of these movies, they're going to another land, and they didn't bother to research what the culture of Morocco is.
Everyone was white.
Not only that, I mentioned to Brandon before we started recording that none of the accents are the same. I mean, you have actors who are trying out a Russian accent. Another one's trying out sort of a vaguely German, Central European accent. And it's like, they didn't even try to, to get that right. Certainly not, culturally appropriate casting. You're absolutely correct, Allison. Everybody's white in this movie. They just grab people off the lot, to stuff them into this movie. Those things are certainly problematic. I don't think they would have even considered, though, trying to go and find actors from that part of the world to try to fill out a movie like this. It would not have been in their thought process.
And I mentioned before, I talked about, Casablanca coming out the same year as this, and while there are white actors passing as other cultures in that as well, they actually did take the time, because there were several refugees from those different countries in Hollywood, and they actually took the time to use those people as extras in those movies. So it could be done back then, but when you're doing a straight drama compared to a slapstick comedy, I guess they thought a little differently. But
I mean, their money went to the songs and then to their big stars. So they would have said, we don't have the budget to go do something like that, which doesn't make it right, but I'm sure that's what the thinking was then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Allison?
So there are about 6 people of color in this movie, and none of them speak.
Yep.
Not one line. They are all silent servants.
Mm-hmm.
They are guards. That they make some jokes to them that they aren't able to be a part of in any way. And one dancer who is a woman of color.
Mm-hmm.
And that is it.
And that that dancer, I found out, I was listening to, there's an audio commentary on the Blu-ray, and they said she was a member of the Catherine Dunham dance troupe. So she was
incredible.
Yeah, very renowned, but I don't think she gets a credit.
I don't think she did.
Yeah.
And it's a crying shame. What she did, some beautiful dance. She did some incredible work. No name.
Yeah.
No lines for any of the men who were guards. And when they speak to them, Hope yeah. and Crosby make some jokes at them, mm-hmm. but they don't get to participate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they're certainly not credited.
No. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, pretty you know, yeah. It's, like we said, you know, it doesn't make it right, but 1942 was a different world. I think people were a lot more ignorant to what was going on in other cultures at the time.
Yeah.
And,
but well, I think it's good that we take a yeah, minute and, yeah. and recognize the work of those people.
Oh, because absolutely.
They were putting in work. I mean, yeah. In particular, the dancing is just beautiful.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And for her to be uncredited is criminal.
Yeah.
And we mentioned it before that, you know, Bing Crosby's very nonchalant about the fact that he sells his friend into slavery.
And yeah. they talk yeah. about slavery a little bit.
They do. And, you know, that left me feeling a little uncomfortable. Just do we know that there was slavery going on in Morocco at that time, or is this Hollywood's, you know,
idea. Yeah.
exactly of what was happening in the Middle East? And I'm no historian to know with certainty, but they should be and should know, and maybe you dealt with that topic a little more sensitively as well, you know. Unfortunately, they needed that to move the plot forward, so it's in this movie. But it too is problematic.
They made quite a few jokes about picking cotton
and
they
Uncle
do.
Absolutely.
Tom's Cabin.
Yes,
they do,
which were mm-hmm. kind of gross.
Yep,
they left a bad taste in my mouth for sure.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. The dichotomy of things that went on back then, because this is also the same year that Holiday Inn came out, and there's a infamous number where Bing Crosby wears blackface. And sings in that. And yet Bing Crosby was the first white entertainer to integrate his radio show to, you know, introduce Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald to the American public. He was known as the first hip white person. So it's amazing, you know, it's amazing the two separate trains of thoughts that would go on. Of course, you know, Crosby didn't have any control of the script or anything like that, but, you know, he certainly had enough pull as a star at the time, you know, so.
Yeah, he could have said something.
Yeah, yeah.
But he didn't.
Yeah.
That we know of.
And yeah. it's, we're learning too right now. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to go from 0 to 100 in wokeness, you know?
Definitely. So, yeah. There's people grow and people get better. None of us are perfect.
Right.
And I mean, we're so three white people.
Yeah, exactly. So for us to even opine on it, probably leaves a bad taste in some people's mouths, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. And I guess our take on it is we're doing our best and we're not here to punch down on this movie or anything like that.
No.
But we also want to make sure we're acknowledging all the problems that are in something like this. So
definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we move on?
Oh, one quick little thing.
Sure.
In the beginning, when they are doing the little voiceover or the little radio, like the ship mm-hmm. blew up situation, mm-hmm. there is an Asian actor.
Yes.
Who puts on a button that says, it has an American flag, and it says, I am Chinese.
Oh, it does. Yeah. Wow.
Yes. I made a big mental note of that because I was like, yikes. Yikes on bikes. Because, our relationship with Asian people in America was very bad at that time.
And was that a blatant World War II response? I mean, the fact that somebody would have
to point
out that they are Chinese, not Japanese, and therefore not an enemy of the United States, is that, I guess I probably should know that, but
that's how I read it. Looking at it now, I don't know how you can really read it as anything else.
Yeah.
Because why would you need the button?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
Specifically with the American flag next to the Chinese flag.
Right. Oh, yeah, man. Because this movie, it was shot in 41, but released in 42. So, yeah, that they could have very well tacked that in, you know, and
could have been added post-production. Later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because those kind of small, yeah.
Even prior to an attack on Pearl Harbor, though, I mean, China was an ally and Japan was part of the Axis. So, I mean, even though we weren't in the war, I'm sure there were pressures at home in the United States on people of Asian descent to say, I'm not this. I mean, it was very shortly after Pearl Harbor that there were Japanese internment camps on the shores of the United States. So those sentiments didn't show up overnight.
That's true. Yep.
Very true. Very, very true. I just felt like when we're talking, since we're talking about racial depictions, that that was worth a mention.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's move on to a lighter topic.
We talked about the heavy stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And Eric, you mentioned that I actually wanted to touch on it though. If they were to remake, as you said, if they were going to remake this, and I can see where different, like Mel Brooks certainly stole from these movies, you know, later on, because his movies are very meta and, you know, a lot of different comedies, but if we were to do like a new road series now, who would you put? Would we do like will we do like a popular singer with a stand-up comic, or will we do something different?
Please, John Mulaney.
Yeah. And I can see that he's that quick-witted and
has some musical background.
Yeah, yeah.
Who would go with him?
Will Smith. I mean, I think if you did those two guys together, you could have Will Smith's great in buddy movies.
He is. Yeah. I'm just thinking of the two of them together would be so funny.
I'm loving it. Let's write it up.
And you know what? And you know
Hollywood,
what?
The listen up.
And you know what? The remake of Aladdin gave me some kind of like road movie vibes every once in a while. So,
Yeah. I saw an interview with, before we talk more about this, I wanted to interject that John Landis had done, apparently loved this entire series of movies. His attempt to make something in that vein was Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase in Spies Like Us. He said the only problem was they couldn't sing. So at least not as good as Bing Crosby and Bob Hope. So that is a movie where they sort of – it's The Road to Moscow, actually, if you watch Spies Like Us. But that was his sort of take on this buddy adventure movie. So in the 80s, I think it's time for a 2020s update on it too, though.
We could do it with two women. Yeah.
Two women could be really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would enjoy that.
You know, somebody like Megan Mullally.
I'll watch her in anything.
Yeah.
And she has incredible musical chops.
Exactly. Yeah.
Broadway performer.
And a comedian. And, I mean, she's got a lot of skills.
Hear me out on this. Megan Mullally, Lauren Graham.
Yeah,
I could see that.
Yeah,
sure.
Because you can get the zany from Mullally, and Lauren Graham can play a little more straight.
Yeah.
She won't be intimidated by the comedy, and she can. I mean, she did Amy Sherman Palladino. Like, she can do fast.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true. And I can see the improvisation. Yeah,
they both played Adelaide.
That's true.
At different times.
That's true. Yeah. You know, man, I'm trying to think of who, like if you had tried to redo it in like the 80s or the 90s, you know, I would have used Robin Williams and,
you know what would have been
Crystal.
But you know what would have been maybe really cool with a Robin Williams is like a Whoopi Goldberg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
The two of them together.
Because there's nothing that says that they both have to be the same gender.
No, you can be opposite genders and be buddies.
Yeah.
And they were so.
Well then great, I've got the perfect idea. It can also be sort of a pseudo sequel to A Star Is Born. We get Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga back together and do it.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. That works.
All right.
That can work.
You got me good.
I think we hit the peak.
That's
on
it.
That one.
Sold.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking here at the when it was released here, and it was actually, Allison, you said, I bet these movies printed money. It was the fourth highest grossing movie in 1942. So,
well, they have those enormous stars singing and being funny, and it's the third one, so people know what they're getting.
Yeah. Right.
And we're, 1942, during World War II, people wanted to escape. So this is the perfect movie to take your mind off of your troubles, and not think what's going on a world away for an hour and a half. Or 82 minutes. I wish people made movies that were 82 minutes.
82 minutes. It's great.
Because I'm like, not every movie has to be two and a half hours.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Some of us have lives and children.
Now, I mean,
some of us have to get up in the morning and teach.
Yeah, and to me, that's the biggest misconception of old movies. Everybody thinks they're long, and I said it's rare. Short. I'm like, only when you had something like A Gone with the Wind or a Ben Hur was it really long. I'm like, Citizen Kane and Casablanca are both under 2 hours.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's great.
It's
you could do dinner and a movie on your date, and it was a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah.
True.
When I think they took this and they cut it down to about a 60-minute version and did a radio play of it after the fact too, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So this thing had legs long after it was in the theaters.
And honestly, to do the whole plot probably takes 25 minutes. So.
Oh, yeah.
So you just have – so all you had to do was take out different gags. Yeah. That was it.
Right.
But here is actually, I found an actual review from the New York Times that Bosley Crowther wrote. He says, let us be thankful that Paramount is still blessed with Bing Crosby and Bob Hope, and that it has set its cameras detailing these two irrepressible wags on another fantastic excursion. Road to Morocco, which came to the Paramount yesterday, for the screen, under present circumstances, can hold no more diverting lure than the prospect of Hope and Crosby ambling, as they have done before, through an utterly slap-happy picture, picking up Dorothy L'Amour along the way and tossing acid wisecracks at each other without a thought for reason or sense. This is the the short of it is that Road to Morocco was a daffy, laugh-drafting film, and you'll certainly agree with The Camel, which at one point offers the gratuitous remark, "This is the screwiest picture I've ever been in."
Yes. That was a good review.
Yeah.
It is a very good review.
I don't
disagree with any of it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And the movie actually was nominated for 2 Oscars. It was nominated for sound recording, and it was nominated for the screenplay. So, and to give credit, we didn't, this movie was directed by a guy named David Butler, who, not known in like the Hitchcock or the Billy Wilder sense, but, directed some good stuff. He directed a lot of, comedies like this. He directed a lot of musicals. He directed a lot of Doris Day stuff. So very audience friendly, I don't think, probably didn't have like a visual style of his own, but serviced what he was given very well and made things that people enjoyed seeing.
They obviously enjoyed it because not only is this the third one, they go on to make 4 more.
Yeah.
They were planning an 8th one in the 70s, and then Bing Crosby passed away, unfortunately. Yeah.
It was going to be called The Road to the Fountain of Youth.
Just a bunch of old guys.
Yeah. And then actually,
that would have been funny. I'm not going to lie.
It would have been great if you, it's on YouTube. There's a great moment where, and I don't think it was planned. I think Bob Hope and Bing Crosby reunite on Johnny Carson at some point in the 70s. Mm. And they still have the same magic. I mean, of course, Hope lived to, he was 100 when he passed away in 2003.
Yeah.
So, and Bing Crosby died unexpectedly in 1977. So that was a loss, it was, we definitely could have had him a little longer. But talk about somebody who has a huge body of work. In 1996 though, Road to Morocco was actually put into the Library of Congress in the National Film Registry. So that's, and then as I mentioned before, We're Off on the Road to Morocco was number 95 on the list of the greatest movie songs, and it was number 78 when the AFI did the 100 funniest movies ever made.
So, yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, so despite all the baggage that it's got,
yeah,
it's an important movie in the history of movies in the United States, in the history mm-hmm. of comedies, in the history of franchise films. So mm-hmm. it's great that we got to talk about it.
Yeah, it's a feel good movie. Like we said, it's a perfect kind of movie for the summer because you don't have to think. It's not.
It was great for me the first week back to school.
Yeah,
and my brain can't take anymore.
Yeah, two incredibly talented individuals who were just magic when you put them together.
So
Eric, any more final thoughts on Road to Morocco?
Yeah, I think that, you know, you can watch this movie one of two ways. You can go in there with very critical eye, and you can beat it up for lots and lots of reasons. And I think we pointed out those reasons here, but I think you could also go in there looking for a good time, and you could laugh. You can recognize the triple threatedness of two great actors, the wonderful skill and ability of Dorothy L'Amour to keep up with them too, and enjoy it, you know, get some popcorn, laugh a little bit, have a good time, disconnect from the problems of the real world today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Allison.
I totally agree. You have to come into it knowing it's from a different time. It's important that we look at these things and note what the problems are, but don't dwell and let that ruin the movie for you, but take uh-huh. note of it so that you say you're not just blankly okay with it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. You're sitting and you're going, I hope that we have learned mm-hmm. from this and have grown beyond this point. And then enjoy some hilarious hijinks.
Yeah.
And talking camels with a really rolly eye. That eye really got me.
Oh gosh. it's just a fun movie. And like I said, I think we don't get, you know, we get a lot of comedies now, but we don't get feel good comedy. Like I feel like a lot of the comedies we get are either gross out comedies or mean spirited comedies. And for all the baggage that we put on this movie, you know, a little earlier, except for the one part, I feel like with Hope, you know, with the mentally disabled stuff, I don't feel like it's mean spirited. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's just two people trying to have fun and trying to enjoy each other's company. And I wish we had a little more, I guess breezy is the word I'm trying to think of. It's a breezy comedy. And it's one of those movies that, you know, on a Sunday afternoon or something, you can stick in and enjoy for 82 minutes and it's not going to take up your whole day. And you're going to have a bunch of laughs. So I'm glad we discussed it. And that would be fun at some point to watch the other ones and talk about those at some point.
Because
I think each of them have, you know, probably some merit and some, you know, I don't know how to rate all of the cultural insensitivity and the rest of them, but because you go from the 40s to the 50s and then the last one in the 60s. So I think we evolved a little bit as each decade went along.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting to do sometime. But next month, Eric and I will be with the release of the Nurse Ratched series coming to Netflix. We're going to be discussing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's the 45th anniversary, and Jay Hoffman will be joining us for that. So looking forward to that. But as we mentioned before, we've had some exciting stuff here on Classics. We talked about Robin Hood a couple months ago. We discussed the 45th anniversary of Jaws with Brian, and we had two great interviews and great guests, and both of whom I think would be willing to come back at some point, I hope. So that would be fun. And you can find us, like I said, on our main feed. This show will be on our own separate Classics feed, but we're on Facebook now. I'm working on getting us on Instagram. I just started that this week. So hopefully we can build and grow. And don't be afraid to ever voice what movies you want us to talk about next. So Once again, for Front Row Classics, I am Brandon Davis.
I'm Eric Flick.
And I'm Allison Means.
And we will see you in the front row.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. You can also find and follow us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter.